Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. And our road trip on Route 51 takes us from the streets of Minneapolis to the battlefields of Iraq, where in spite of a U.S. invasion, years of combat, and the overthrow of a regime, there is a country in chaos with reports of atrocities and terrorist attacks that are shocking the world and, unfortunately, inspiring disaffected young people in the West, including America, to join what has been called ISIS, ISIL, and the Islamic State. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we welcome back to our airwaves Sammy Rizzulli, a Minneapolis businessman who grew up in Iraq and then returned to his homeland in 2003 following the U.S. invasion. He is back in the Midwest this week, meeting with a number of people, including an audience at the UW Center for Civic Engagement in Wausau. Sammy Rizzulli has reached out to heal the religious divide in his adopted hometown of Minneapolis. He is the founder of the Muslim-Jewish Dialogue of Minnesota, and his appearance in Wausau was sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service and the Merrill Peace Study Group. We also welcome back to Route 51 Jeff Lee, an associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County, who has traveled with students to Lebanon and other parts of the Mideast. And as always, we welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, our lines are open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Jeff Lee and Sammy Rizzulli, thanks so much for being with us on Route 51 today.
Well, thank you very much, Glenn.
Well, thank you for having us, Glenn.
Let's start with you, Sammy. What is the Muslim Peacekeeper Team Iraq, this group that you lead?
Well, actually, it's called Muslim Peacemakers Teams in Iraq, and it follows the model of the Christian Peacemaker Teams in the U.S., Canada, and U.K. Right after my return back in 2004, I met the beautiful men and women of that organization, the Christian Peacemaker Teams, which is CPT, in Karbala with no prior knowledge about them, no clue about what they were doing, and without any pre-arrangement, actually, accidentally, I met them in an organization where I helped my brother-in-law working for human rights. It's called Human Rights Watch, Karbala. So they were scheduled to be there, and I just met them, and they were surprised to meet with me, and we spoke. We learned about their mission. First question I asked them, I told them, well, I'm an Iraqi-American. Because I'm an Iraqi, I was driven to come here to do something. What drove you guys from Canada, UK, and U.S., and if you're white, you have no connection with Iraq like I do. I was born here. They said, Sammy, you're absolutely wrong. We're here. We just want to remind you, even before the war started, we are here because our father, Abraham, was born in Ur. You are north of Basra. And Abraham is the father of the three religions, and Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. So we're here to remind our brothers and sisters that war launched by George Bush Jr. is not in our name. So they were walking door to door, introducing themselves. We have written one page, they call it a magic sheet, introduced themselves, and they were welcomed by locals because they were the only Americans who were not armed. So they just moving from city to city, promoting peace, and tell them there are many Americans and Canadians and British, Britons who are against the war, but they couldn't get the chance to say, but they went in millions demonstrating on the streets prior to the war, but the war happened. So they were courageously there carrying this message among the Iraqis.
So is this all on the level of outreach, of making contact with individual people and talking to them, or do you do other concrete things to help out in the situations there?
After the math of the war, there were lots of young men and women missing from their families, in prisons and the U.S. custodies and in the U.S. Military camps. So those, the peacemakers, the CPTers, and later the MPTers, the Muslim peacemaker teams, we were taking names who their families were looking for them. They were missing. And we had the ability to speak English and communicate with the U.S. Military officers to have appointment meeting with them and looking for those missing children and bringing their news to their parents, to their communities. If they are killed, so we know they are killed, their families, they stop looking for them, or at least we work to help to have their family meeting them if they are abducted or in the custody of the U.S. military camps in Baghdad and in the area of the south, the southern, about nine provinces in the south of Baghdad and also in the north.
Well, Sami Rasuli, you've got dual citizenship. You're an American citizen. You were a businessman for many years in Minneapolis. And you're a native Iraqi, but this sounds like dangerous work, even for someone like you who would be able to blend in better than most people.
That's true. I spend almost my half life in born and raised in environmental that defined as a Muslim culture. So I understood the culture, spoke the language, and also when I migrated when I was at 26 to the U.S., I was lucky to have a business, and I was very much lucky, more lucky to be supported by locals. And I led a very successful business, so
Sami, this was the restaurant Sinbad's, correct?
Yes.
I imagine a number of people who've been to Minneapolis still remember it. Is the business still open?
No, I sold the business when I decided to go back, but my successor was able to continue about 4 years. Then he lost the lease. And the business closed down, but people are still talking about it. My kids urging me, whom I gave them the option to continue the mission of Sinbad's, but at that time they were young and they said, "We're not crazy like you, Dad. Restaurant is not easy business." But now they are after me to renew the project, and they want to take over. But
so they don't think you're crazy for going back to Iraq and putting yourself back in the maelstrom there.
They think you were crazy
for being a restaurant owner.
Yes. Many people from here and there. When I arrived there, they said, "Sami, everybody want to leave. How come you're back?" And here they said, "Uh-oh, you're like salmon, the fish that goes upstream and never comes back, so we want you back." So, but for me, it was a way of healing because all of a sudden I found myself, I am the oppressed, and I am the oppressor as an American, the oppressor as an Iraqi, and I chose to be the bridge.
Jeff Lee, comment, if you could, on Sami Rasuli's story and this dual identity he has and the message that he passed along to the audience, which was really a pretty good audience Tuesday night here in Wausau, considering there wasn't a lot of publicity for his visit.
Right. We started putting this together maybe about a week ago. We only found out last minute that Sami would be available. We found a venue. We got the message out, and 43 people came, which is really rather remarkable turnout. And the great inspirational message that I took away from Sammy is this premium that he places on the idea that we're all one, and that we all contribute to this, and that we all can find our commonality rather than emphasize our differences. That was one of the most important things that I saw. And Sam, you had a really good story to that effect, talking about religion within your own family, with you and your wife and your children. Could you share some of that message?
Oh yeah, definitely. As I told my audience, we all, no exception, found ourselves inheriting our faith from our families, from our ancestors, on and on. But one of my son had the opportunity not to be like his parents' faith. So he chose to be a Baptist, and he claimed he is a Christian, which he thought it was hard on me when he told me. Of course, he kept that secret until he became 18. He said, "Dad, I want to talk to you," after I had a really beautiful a birthday party for him at my Simbad's with some belly dancers. So he said, "Dad, after math, the party, can I speak to you?" And I told him, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Dad, you might don't like this, but I'm a Christian. I'm not like you, a Muslim." And I said, "Wow, this an opportunity. I never had it before, so it's good for you." And this is what's nice about this country when immigrants come here to adopt the culture, to adopt the all the ideas when people are at their adult age, free to choose. And that's what's beautiful about America. And that's what made me to emigrate and leave Iraq when Saddam Hussein, at a certain time, he addressed the Iraqis. He told them, "If you're not with me, you're against me."
So you left Iraq specifically because of Saddam Hussein?
Oh, yeah. That,
but you weren't happy about the U.S. going in there and deposing Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely. Well, Saddam Hussein was not the U.S. problem. Saddam Hussein was the Iraqis' problem, and the Iraqis who were capable to change not only one, two, three regimes, but they were able to remove Saddam. And it was just their thing. It's not the outsider's thing like the U.S. and the Britain and other countries who helped to make the invasion possible. So I left Iraq, but the same tone I heard George Bush telling the whole world from ground zero after 9/11, he was saying, everybody should hear me, and here I am asking you, if you're not with me, you're against me. So then in 2003, I couldn't believe that my own country, by choice, start bombing, leading the shock and awe bombing campaign which destroyed lots of lives and disseminated the families that they lived in peace, even under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator. But security was secure, the education was good, the health was good. Iraq was known as a middle-class society, so we had lots of professionals who kept the country intact under his brutality.
You know, there's a sense, Sammy Rizzulli, among some in the West, that the Arab Spring a few years ago went too far, too fast. And for better or for worse, according to these people, many of these dictatorial regimes, whether they're in Libya or Egypt or Syria, are, for all of their human rights abuses, keeping the radical Islamic fundamentalists in line. How do you respond to that perspective?
Well, it's known. I just can tell you what the Iraqis are talking about. With watching not only the Iraqi case, Libya, Egypt, and Syria today, we are wondering why the U.S. removed secular dictators, bringing in groups of militia that religiously very extremist, which turn the situation, the whole situation in the Middle East, upside down with a turmoil of instability and gloomy future. That's a big puzzle that right now the people are asking and saying why.
Would we be having, Sami Rasuli, the problems in your homeland of Iraq if Saddam Hussein were still in power?
I don't think so. There is a person, a Zionist. I don't know if he's still Israeli, but I think he runs once a while for our office in Israel. His name is Bernard Henry Levy. He was born in Algeria, and then his family moved, very wealthy family moved to France, and he's an author. I think he's about my age or a little bit older, about 65 years old. He helped, as I researched him, to initiate those malicious groups, whether the Taliban in Afghanistan, the extremists in Libya, and others in Syria, al-Nusra, and all these extremists. And the reason I'm talking about this, in 2002, he was in northern Iraq trying to initiate another cell of extremists called Al-Jihad with Tawheed. But Saddam's intelligence at that time was very strong, and his grip of holding the country in one piece was supported by many people. So he was able, Saddam's forces were able to go after this guy and drive him away with the people he was trying to install.
So for all of his faults, Saddam Hussein, who we deposed in Iraq, for all of his faults, you're saying that he kept things stable and allowed professionals and technicians and educators and intellectuals and a middle class to thrive, and there is no middle class in Iraq anymore.
No. We have the illiterate right now ratio replaced the unfortunately the middle class. An old woman, Iraqi woman, was asked about Saddam Hussein, how she thinks about him, and she said he was a terrible dictator, and he was so bad, very bad. Then she was asked about the current government of al-Maliki and followed by al-Abadi, and she said those folks made Saddam look really good. So they didn't bring something better or prove that Iraq has been moved from a dictator to a real democracy and freedom.
Yeah, Glenn, this is all really a set of complicated issues. You know, I mean, we go back to the end of World War One and the establishment of all these new Arab nation states in the Middle East over lands that had never really been singular countries before: Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and you know, to a large degree, the list can go on. The borders being, of course, established by the British and the French. The Middle East, of course, and this is something that Suli has Sami has talked about before, is certainly a very diverse region in terms of ethnicities, in terms of religions, and of course, divisions within those religions themselves. And so, what you do is you create states that, I guess every state's borders on the planet are to a degree artificial, but these are ones that are very rapidly created and new systems are imposed. And what that means is whole new political sets of networking have to take place within and across all these different fracture lines within these societies. If you look at Syria from independence in 1946 until Hafez al-Assad came to power in the late 60s and stabilized in the 70s, you had 13 coups. If you look between 1958 and 1970 in Iraq, you had 4 coups. Then under the Ba'athist dictatorships of Hafez al-Assad in Syria and first Saddam Hussein's uncle, I believe, and then under Saddam Hussein after 1979, you do have relative stability. And if you look at Iraq, as Sammy was saying, during the 70s, before Saddam Hussein himself was in full power, yeah, you were substantially building an Iraqi middle class. That oil wealth was finally going to building schools and hospitals and really generating a new kind of society there. Of course, in the 80s and then the 90s with Saddam Hussein's wars, a lot of that caved in. But for a short period there, there was some real substantial social growth. And it is true that, the dictators have been able to successfully coup-proof. And what that means is they've been able to, create a system of government that insulates them in power. Now, not necessarily that the people are better off long term, because again, if we look from the 1980s to the mid 2000s, the economies are generally going backwards. We got about 0.25% growth across the Arab world per year in, GDP. 0.25%. Horrible negative growth when you think that the population is more than doubling. And so the problems are expanding and expanding and expanding. And of course, these dictatorships can keep the lid on things, but they can't really solve those problems.
And Sammy, I'd like you to comment on what's going on right now in Iraq with this group, ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State, and the horrific things that they're doing in your homeland, putting a man in, a cage and burning him alive, crucifying people, beheading innocent people, taking young girls and putting them into slavery. You know, even in a world that's kind of numb to atrocities, it seems like we've never seen anything quite this bad before.
Well, generally speaking, we know lives evolve and people evolve, and what people generally need is a dignified homes and job and stability. But as long you have ongoing wars, and that benefits the manufacturer of the arms who likes to have the wars going on to benefit out of it. And we know the top 100 arms sales factories, about 59% of the beneficiaries of those 100 top arms sales companies are the United States companies, led by Lockheed Martin and Boeing. That what the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute recently issued the report about the arms sales in 2013 and prior year.
Sammy, less and less. Sammy, let me interrupt you. We're aware of the arms sales and how American armaments are finding themselves into all parts of the world. But my question was specifically about ISIS and these incredibly brutal acts. Why would you put a man in a cage and burn him alive and videotape it and send it out to the entire world?
Well, you're asking me. I really don't know, because if you know who are ISIS, then I know. And this is truly my position, because I was in Erbil in June 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th of 2014. And I was there to pick up my friend who couldn't come to Najaf from New York, Tom Fazy. He's a professor, pathologist, retired. He comes, he has some projects with the Kufa University. So he couldn't come to Najaf, which is south of Baghdad. We have an airport there, but he couldn't reserve a ticket there. It was not available. So I told him, why don't you go to Erbil and I can pick you up from there. It's an internal flight for me, and bring you to Najaf. So we stayed there 4 days. And what got my attention, some speaking Arabic workers at the hotel we were staying. And because the area in Erbil is Kurdish, and they're supposed to speak Kurdish or English. So they said, we are Arabs, and I asked them, are you from the south? They said, no, we're from Mosul, from Nineveh.
Uh-huh.
Then I asked him, how is the situation in Nineveh? They said, terrible. Armed militia are taken over, and there is no such central government army or forces in Mosul, and we cannot go to see our our families. So we haven't been there for a long time, and lots of young people cannot find jobs there. They smuggle themselves by a way or another to cross the city lines coming to Erbil, because Erbil and Mosul are adjacent cities in the north. So he never said any word about ISIS. He never mentioned Daesh in Arabic. And I mentioned this, the acronym ISIS or Daesh. Arabs never use these terms when they speak about, when they name things. They name it in full words.
Well, but whatever you call it, these atrocities are, you know, just above and beyond what we're used to seeing, even in the horrors of war.
Right, right. Let me tell you this. We all seen Daesh, of course, or ISIS, were burning this man in a cage who was Jordanian. They did it somewhere in Syria. I don't know where they have done this, but we saw them destroying the Iraqi civilization remnants in museums in Mosul. You saw that, right?
Yeah, the wholesale destruction of Iraqi art. These are priceless works that go back thousands of years to the very dawn of human civilization. Why would somebody do that?
Right. But the word that we learned from insiders while I was there, and they told us the real antiquities, the artifacts, they were smuggled outside of the country for a profit, while fake ones, they like duplicates or whatever we've seen, was not the real artifacts that they destroyed. So when I talked about the arms sales, right after the similar group in Libya executed 25 Coptic, Egyptian Coptic individuals, right after that, the Sisi regime bombed them, but on the same days, Egyptians and Libyans found an endless amount of weapons dropped by air on the border, like initiating with this group a kind of dispute or something illustrate an animosity between Egypt and Libya, and to wage a war between two countries, just what happened between Saudi Arabia and Yemen recently. The amount of weapon was dropped by air. Who has the logistics and the ability? I mean, I can show you video of this amount of all kind of weapons dropped in there.
Sammy, look, we have to take a break. We're way over. I'm going to take a short break, and then we're going to pick up the conversation where we're at. We're talking to Sammy Rizzulli, who he's got dual citizenship. He's a member of the Muslim Peacemaker Team, Iraq. Born in Iraq, became a Minneapolis businessman, and he is sharing his story with us and with Jeff Lee of UW Marathon County. Back after this.
Many rivers to cross, and it's only my will that keeps me alive. I've been lit, washed up for years, and I merely survive because of my pride.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include J.W. Jung Seed Company, Wollersheim Winery, and Rockweiler Insulation. You too can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer-Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-Law.com.
Tribal War. We're back on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio with Mideast peace activist, Minneapolis businessman, Iraqi native Sami Rasuli, talking about the situation in Iraq and around the world for that matter, and also Jeff Lee, an associate professor of history at UW Marathon County. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Jeff Lee, I'd like you to react to some of the things that Sami Rasuli was saying before the break.
Sure. You know, and on the last point, I think we need to look into the veracity of the photo evidence. And remember, you know, we've been doctoring photos since there have been photos. You find that way back from the late 19th century. And even during the Civil War, they doctored some of those battlefield photos to get their point across. So we have to be kind of careful with that and do a little more, deep analysis. Bernard Henry Levy, he's a kind of a second rank French public intellectual. And so, again, I don't know how important I would consider him, but there's always people moving around trying to foment this and that, so I wouldn't give extreme importance to him in any of this. I think more broadly, more importantly, though, if we want to try to understand ISIS, I think there's two important things that we could look at. And one, if we think historically, you go all the way back to the French Revolution, and you have Robespierre, right, the radical leader of the Jacobins during the Reign of Terror, saying no enemies to the left. We don't allow anybody to be more radical than us. And so when the Reign of Terror happened, they weren't going after the nobles first. They were going after the anarchists, not to allow anybody more extreme than them. They would be the final uncompromising answer. You found the Bolsheviks in 1917 picking up that line too, Lenin leading the Bolsheviks against internal dissent, saying, no, we will not compromise with the provisional government, with the other socialists, with the liberals, etc. We will stay pure to a doctrine, and as things deteriorate, we will be the last man standing, the only one who can provide a real alternative. If you look at ISIS, remember ISIS has rejected and condemned al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. They've rejected and condemned the Taliban. All the other groups that you might think are like-minded, ISIS has said those are compromisers. Those are people who are not willing to devote themselves 100% to the caliphate. The caliphate relies upon having a single and unquestionable leader who is of Quraishi descent, the tribe of Muhammad, a leader who can control territory, a leader who can impose Sharia law in their view, absolutely, and again, an absolutist interpretation of Sharia law. And so in that regard, they can attract people from around the world who are dictated or who are addicted to the absolute, people who want an absolute final answer and no more compromise of any sort. And every society produces these kinds of people. But, of course, there are only so many of them and so many of them willing actually to go and fight on the ground. On the ground, you'll find these foreign fighters. You obviously find some people of that mentality from the region. But then, as Sami was saying, you find these poor people who need a job. And these poor people can't find any other alternative. And so they end up getting caught in and sometimes caught on the ISIS side of things, and they have a hard time getting back out of that.
Sami Rasuli, is that, in your view, how ISIS has been able to attract Westerners, people from Europe, Canada, and America to this fight in Iraq?
Well, we have to look at the spider in the web because, again, any narrative, any discussion, any dialogue about what's going on without looking at the beneficiary of what's going on, it's really nonsense. Because I learned in America to follow the money or to follow the benefiter of what's going on. And the only state is in the area benefiting of this chaotic situation is Israel. So we should not ignore the role of the Israeli action behind the scene or on the ground, because they want to send the message, the Israelis, and saying Daesh or Hamas is just like ISIS, and we have to eradicate Hamas, which is the whole population of Gaza, to keep grabbing land day after day by the settlement, which is purely theft. And if we are talking about Islamic State today, why didn't we talk about a Jewish state that was racist from one day, its establishment in 1948, when they came, the Jews escaping the Holocaust to the east, where the Palestinians, the Arabs, and Muslims received them with open arms and hosted them, but with the Zionism idea to establish the state of Israel was just stripping away the whole land, the whole country, from a peaceful people who are the Palestinians, with the help of the West, headed by the U.S. USA to support that project, and all these extremists and the situation that we have today.
Sammy Rizzulli,
only in recent history.
Sammy Rizzulli, let me interrupt you, please.
Sammy, 14 centuries old.
Sammy, let me interrupt you, please.
What's happening before 1948?
Sammy, let me interrupt you, please. Are you saying that Israel as a country shouldn't exist?
No. We're not talking about this. But what's going on? There is a difference between two things: the beauty of Judaism and the ugliness of the Zionism. And what we have in Israel is a baby of a Zionism. In 1887, in a speech at the Sorbonne, the French scholar Ernest Renan observed that forgetting is a crucial factor in the creation of nation. So what we've been seeing, it's lies and lies, layers of lies in the creation of Israel, because Israel is the point. And now Israel exists, will not go away. The U.S., who is supporting the Israeli, is not going away. It will continue, but we have to have a solution for the Palestinians. We cannot focus on ISIS and ignore what the Palestinians are suffering from.
Well, we're not ignoring that, but we are doing a show today on what's going on in Iraq and ISIS, so that's also important to talk about.
Right.
Now you're leading Sammy. You're leading something called the Muslim – Sammy Rizzulli, would you please let me ask you a question? Sammy, you're leading something called the Muslim-Jewish Dialogue of Minnesota.
Yeah.
When you bring these things up to the Jewish people in Minneapolis, how do they react?
Well, Glenn, all my supporters are Jews, and they are not happy with the action of Israel. In the United States, we have something today called the Stockholm Syndrome. We cannot criticize the action of Israel because we will be labeled as anti-Semite. Given the fact the Israelis or the Jews are not the only Semite, the Arabs are Semite, and we are cousins. But we got to live together. We cannot just keep stealing lands and grabbing the whole country and driving the poor peaceful Palestinians out of their homeland and not talking about. And each narrative, I mean, the mainstream media here, they don't talk about this. And all the chaotic situation resulted because of what's going on for the Palestinians.
Well, we've got you on the air here talking about it. And Jeff Lee, I'd like you to respond.
Okay, sure. There's a lot there. You know, we go back into the 1880s, but really the 1890s, more importantly, to the birth of Zionism. Now, there were people talking about going back and repopulating the old historic lands of Judea and Samaria, etc. But it really becomes a mass movement in the 1890s. Under the threat of European anti-Semitism. So if we want to talk about Zionism, really you have to understand it as at first a secular Jewish nationalism, right? In response to the Dreyfus Affair in France, in response to the pogroms in Eastern Europe, in response to the increasing pressure placed upon Jews by the rise of European nationalisms that often depicted the Jew as an outsider, you had Jewish people throughout Europe abandoning assimilation and going to this idea that all of us are Jews are one. In fact, that's exactly what Theodor Herzl said, is it's you non-Jews who made us Jews, who made us a separate people. And then there's this idea that develops, well, we've got to go someplace and establish a nation state. And, of course, those old lands in what the Romans originally called Palestine, those are the lands that, of course, made the most cultural sense. And so there is a movement there. And what you have is you've got a collision of peoples. You have – I think it's more important to call them Europeans than to call them Jewish. You have people coming in with European skills. You have people coming in with European money. $400 million is invested in Palestine during the 1920s and 30s in one of the poorest countries on the planet. These Zionist entrepreneurs are buying land often from absentee Arab landowners, and then they're kicking the peasants off of the land. There's not that much effort being made to try to create a joint economy, but rather the local population is being displaced. And since then, of course, we've had war after war, and it's easy to make an argument talking about Israeli expansionism, one, just because of the facts, but also because of the intemperate statements of many Jewish politicians. Still, it doesn't all add up singularly to one thing like the greater Zionist project, right? This idea of an Israel over most of the Fertile Crescent. What you have is a lot of diversity of evidence. Sharon, for instance, in the disengagement plan is, of course, going against that idea of continuous expansion. So you know, there's an argument to be made there about Israeli expansion, and there is diversity of opinion within Israel and among the Jewish community worldwide on that. But all the evidence doesn't add up to one single point of view.
All right. We're going to pick up on this again after we take a short break. You're listening to Sami Rasuli, Mideast peace activist, Iraqi-American citizen, and Jeff Lee of UW-Marathon County. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio.
Well, everywhere is war.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Northwind Renewable Energy of Stevens Point, designing and installing solar systems, highly efficient wood boiler systems, and providing deep energy retrofits to buildings. Northwind's project portfolio is available at northwindre.com.
Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me.
If you're just joining us, we're in the final stages of a conversation with Sami Rasuli, Mideast peace activist, Minneapolis businessman, Iraqi native who returned to his homeland of Iraq after the U.S. invasion. He is back in the Midwest now from the Mideast, talking about some of his concerns there and about his efforts to build peace among the various factions. We also have Jeff Lee, an associate professor of history at UW-Marathon County. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Sami Rasuli, I've got to ask you if you're concerned about the kind of backlash that we've seen in some quarters against Muslims in the United States because of attacks like the one at the Boston Marathon and this most recent incident involving this cartoon contest in Texas that to a lot of people seemed deliberately provocative. And the reason I'm bringing it up, there are plans to build a mosque in Wausau, and it would be the first of its kind here. And while it was welcomed by many local religious leaders, there were some anti-Muslim comments in the Daily Herald, some pointing to the destruction of Christian churches in Muslim countries, and one writer saying, how long before they kill us here? You know, and when you see this kind of reaction from not a majority of Americans, but a subset of them, how do you stop that? How do you combat it?
Well, starting with the event 9/11/2001, that event, which was horrific and inflicted lots of death on innocent people, the story of that event came to us from only the official source. Was no second or third investigation, and lots of voices were heard high, loud, that event was an inside job. I'm not saying that's true, but things need to be investigated. Right after Charlie Hebdo and Paris event, we heard the Russian media and also here, the U.S., some writers raised some questions about what happened and if that whether was a false flag operation meant to discredit Islam and feed the Islamophobia. And what we're witnessing in Texas just recently are killing three innocent students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a few months ago. It comes and pours in the same direction of getting the animosity between Muslims and their brothers and sisters from different faith and ethnic background.
Jeff Lee, how could the 9/11 attacks be an inside job? I mean, really, the logistics involved with that. How could anyone possibly set explosives in those buildings and do something like that? It defies credibility.
Well, you know, first of
course,
don't
forget the Building 7. Please talk about that too.
Well, there's no question that Islamophobia has existed in the West for almost as long as Islam has existed. That's definitely a problem, and you definitely have these people in Texas, for instance, and this individual in North Carolina. It's about parking, but he only shot the Muslims over the parking issue. He didn't shoot anybody else that he had parking issues with. And so Islamophobia is there. It's always easy to scapegoat. It's always easy to blame the other, et cetera. So far as 9/11 goes, the 9/11 Commission was a remarkably detailed investigation, one of the most detailed, thorough investigations that's ever been conducted. A lot of the kind of claims, so there was the claim that none of the Jews went to work in the towers. Well, that's not true. 400 Jews died in the towers that day. The idea that U.S. Security and law enforcement weren't there, that's not true either. There's no real evidence to support an inside job.
I don't want to get bogged down in this when we've only got a couple of minutes left. Sammy Rizzulli, I need you to kind of wrap things up for me and tell me what hopes you see for us developing peace between these three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, not just in your homeland of Iraq, but all across the world.
What's happening today is byproduct of what happened initially in 1948 when Israel was established and still Palestinians have no rights to exist. Not the Israelis. Their Israelis are existing already. They have their state and they are accepted by the whole world community. But the Palestinians still are struggling to get their homeland, whether it's within one homeland solution or two countries. So if things are not corrected to the Palestinians and offering them the dignified life just like anybody else, I think things will go worse and worse in the whole Middle East.
So it's the solution of the Palestinian and Israeli problem that lies at the core of the problems
Yes.
in the Middle East is what you're saying.
Definitely.
Sammy Rizzulli, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for spending some of it with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We want to thank today's guests, Mideast peace activist Sammy Rizzulli and UW Marathon County Associate Professor of History Jeff Lee. Sammy Rizzulli's appearance in Wausau this week was sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service and the Merrill Peace Study Group. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Special music today by Al Hassan, Woost El Balad, Jimmy Cliff, Third World, Bob Marley and the Wailers, Gladys Knight, and John Lennon. Next week on Route 51, we talk to the people behind Wisconsin's new Aquaponics Innovation Center, which is something that has just been developed at Nelson and Pade, an aquaponics company in Montello. We'll have them managers of that company, Rebecca Nelson and John Pade, with us. Also, Chris Hartlib of UW Stevens Point, manager of the Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility in Bayfield. To give you some background, the research is aimed at creating the first commercially successful walleye fish farming business in the world, and it is one of the programs that is scheduled to be cut in Governor Walker's budget. Remember to follow us on Facebook. This program will be put online and can later be downloaded at wpr.org/Route 51, and it will be repeated Friday night on 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.